Culture can be defined as the social behavior and norms found in human societies. Those behaviors and norms mesh together to help form human identity. Culture gives human beings social location, a place of belonging, and ethnic connection. But what happens when culture is either consciously or unconsciously misrepresented or appropriated for means other than helping people ground themselves in the world? What are the effects and consequences of those actions? Today, we talk to Surabhi Mahajan, who sets spaces across the state via the Oregon Humanities Conversation Project, to explore how culture affects who we know ourselves to be and what happens when it is appropriated and misrepresented. I hope you'll join the conversation today on The Keenest Observers. On the phone today, I have Surabhi Mahajan. Surabhi Mahajan is a longtime resident and active community member in Salem, Oregon, who works for food access in her community. Her experience as part of a family of immigrants and a woman of color with a college education has helped her understand how different aspects of her culture have informed her place in the world. She talks with fellow Oregonians to discuss how cultural appropriation shapes individuals' experiences and identities. She is currently the community food education coordinator at the Marion Polk Food Share in Salem, Oregon. Surabhi Mahajan, thanks for joining us.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Most definitely, most definitely. Before we get into the good, juicy part of this mm-hmm. issue, what are the Oregon Humanities Conversation Projects?
Yeah, so Oregon Humanities does a whole range of programming, but one of them is to have conversation projects, and it is just to set aside the time and space for Oregonians to have difficult conversations, conversations that are challenging or a little bit uncomfortable that we may not get to have day to day. But the goal is just to set aside time and space and have a facilitator who's passionate about a subject facilitate a topic that a community wants to have and hasn't had the chance to have. And may find it difficult to have it, but, you know, that they can have it with just to have these things taken care of.
Mm-hmm. And the organization itself provides public programs,
exactly.
Grant and funding possibilities for organizations and people to do yeah. work as well across the humanities.
Yeah. They have a magazine that comes out yeah. quarterly. Yeah.
Yeah. Really great magazine, actually.
Yeah.
So what prompted you to want to mm-hmm. do a conversation project and on cultural appropriation?
I've been having a lot of difficult conversations about cultural appropriation. Like, I think it definitely is a thing, and experiencing it myself as a student in college and then after college, just seeing it in the community in Oregon, especially like folks like in Oregon think we're super liberal or that maybe racism or issues of racism aren't a thing. And then experiencing cultural appropriation and feeling the effects of it and feeling the effects of racism happen. I've been having a lot of frustrating conversations about cultural appropriation and slowly, like, especially online, you know, online conversations aren't that productive sometimes because you can't see the other person and you can't, you aren't open-minded to their perspective. And so I saw this as an opportunity to kind of explore the idea of cultural appropriation with a lot of people face to face. And I wanted to know what that would look like and what that would feel like, if it would feel frustrating, like a lot of online conversations have felt, or a lot of in-person, like one-on-one conversations have felt as well, just about cultural appropriation. But then actually, like, the result has been the opposite, that people actually come to the conversations and very open-minded, and they just want to know what it is, because they've heard a lot. They probably had some frustrating conversations as well. So I think that's why I just wanted to see what it would be like. And especially with this experience, like, I tell people that I'm not an expert in it at all. Like, I don't have a PhD. I just want to talk to them about it just as much as I have before. And so it's been a pretty good experience so far.
Yeah. I look forward to delving in as our conversation progresses yeah. to see how, what that experience has been, but let's define cultural appropriation, especially from your lens and how you've been doing the work. How do you define it in your spaces?
Yeah, I think that was great that you defined what culture is. And then, so I do like an activity in my conversations. I have people define what culture is and then what appropriation is. And then we come together and define what cultural appropriation is. So instead of giving them like a textbook definition and then talking about it, they kind of define what it is for themselves. And appropriation is like the act of taking something from a designated source and putting it onto another action. And there isn't this set of power dynamics in appropriation itself. And so then I introduce like power dynamics, and then we are able to identify what cultural appropriation is. So the full definition would be the action of taking an aspect from a minority or a marginalized group's culture by a member of a dominant group and resulting in the exploitation or the benefit to the dominant group.
Great, great. Do you find that there's a divergence in definition space to space? Or
yeah.
Do you find that you, okay, that folk do come, so it's different.
Yeah.
How I would love to hear how that's kind of
yeah.
kind of diverged between, you know, spaces that you've kind of
right.
been.
Yeah. So I think folks, like, especially with the culture, folks just end up coming up with everything, like all the different aspects of it. With appropriation, some folks, because they've heard of cultural appropriation before, they want to put the power aspect into it, you know, in some spaces. But then a lot of spaces, they just want to, they just get to the definition of it. But I feel like across the board, no matter what space I've been in, I've had a discussion about like that power element or that dominant element in the definition. Folks kind of have a difficulty accepting the privilege that comes with being in a dominant group, as well as the idea that power structures still exist in today's society.
Okay, that's a great jumping off point as we move it into our first break, and we'll come back and kind of insert right there. If you're just joining us, I'm Robert Goodwin. My guest is Surabhi Mahajan, and we're talking about cultural appropriation and the Oregon Humanities Conversation Projects that she leads. Stay with us. First, a short break. Welcome back to the Jefferson Exchange. I'm Robert Goodwin. We're talking to Surabhi Mahajan about cultural appropriation and identity and her work via Oregon Humanities and conversation projects that Oregon Humanities does across the state. You're welcome to join this conversation. Call us at 800-838-3760 or email comments and questions to jx@jeffnet.org. Surabhi, you were talking about a couple of things that piqued, you know, my ear in terms of like the construction of your conversations and the difference between social media conversations versus face-to-face conversations and the projects, and how you got into power dynamics once you got into the face-to-face conversations.
Mm-hmm.
What were the differences, and how did that? I know that there are definite differences. People tend to like let their civility go online. Right.
Mm-hmm.
And do you find that once you get people face to face that they remain civil as they start getting into the uncomfortable spaces of like power dynamics within this area?
Yeah, I would say like the biggest group I've had is about 50. And at that size of a group, like I personally, like I can't keep track of every single person in the room, but and the smallest has been about 10. But in between that size, like, I can usually keep track of, like, how people are doing individually. And, like, I have definitely seen people get visibly frustrated or exasperated with the definition or with this idea of, like, power dynamics still existing or folks currently being held responsible for power dynamics And then, but I'm able, like, when I identify folks that are struggling or like frustrated with that aspect, like, I kind of have to slow down just to talk a little bit, like, the conversation that we're having, and then go back and explain why those power dynamics are still important, or how folks are still benefiting or still struggling with the power dynamics aspect of it in today's society, even in Oregon. And I think a lot of the different conversations that, like, Walida Imarasha has had about, like, Oregon's racist history, that's really helped, you know, that's, it's become such a popular talk that it's helped me, I can just reference to it and people know what I'm talking about, you know, that they can identify that, yeah, Oregon does have, like, up until very recently, and still continues to, I mean, with the Max thing last year, has a very racist past, and power dynamics still exist, so people can't deny it after we talk it through. Sometimes there'll be a few folks that will just want to be hostile, or, like, and that's only happened once, where it's just a couple of people do not want to engage or do not want to admit to it. But on across the board, everybody's, like, worked through it, I think, and even the participants end up helping other participants out, that it doesn't become my responsibility, you know, that people, because they want to have a conversation and they want to talk about it too. So it's like they help other folks out to like back up why it's still a thing, or why cultural appropriation is a valid thing to talk about. And then people, they end up realizing it because it's, you know, it's a community thing. It becomes a community-centered thing and not a personal thing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I want to, like, delve into that a little bit. We should say, yeah, that Walida Imarasha is another scholar, writer, yeah, poet who has a conversation project via the Oregon Humanities that, yeah, deals with the racial history of Oregon and its foundations, yeah, and founding. So let's get into the topic a little bit. I mean, and especially I would love to know how you structure these conversations even more specifically, mm-hmm, because I think when we talk about cultural appropriation, you know, that's a definition and a tag that folk may not know. You know, we talk about, we stated a definition, but we don't know necessarily how examples of that term, you know, are applied in day-to-day living or what we see. So there are spaces like restaurants, for example, in the Oregon community that I see that are, you know, that people, I've had conversations with where folk from particular cultures are kind of upset because, right, you know, they've been from a particular culture and people are kind of benefiting from what seems to be appropriative work. So how do you get into that, you know, I guess structurally as well as, you know, in responses?
Yeah. So in the beginning, like, I like to have folks introduce themselves, and if it's a small enough group or, like, it's a manageable enough group, we can all do it together. And then, like, introduce themselves, especially with a part of it, their identity that belongs to a larger cultural group. And I'll usually start, and my example is, like, I really like Harry Potter. Like, that's how I learned to read English, you know, like complicated English, I guess. And Harry Potter is a cultural group, you know, it's got art, it's got language, it's got, like, text, it's got a place now in Florida and then in Europe, or, you know, so I would argue that it's a cultural group. So it's like that kind of sets the pace that it's like you part of your identity that's not just racial or ethnic or gender or, you know, like that's not just something related to, you know, that you can kind of expand what culture is and kind of, and a lot of folks in the dominant culture think that they don't have a cultural group. And so a lot of people will say, like, in response to this question, that I guess I'm just me, you know, I guess I'm just an individual. And then I kind of want to push back because when you think you're just yourself, or, you know, that's a privileged thing. Like, that's the thing where, the dominant, there is no culture, but no, there is a culture that people have to either assimilate to, or it's enforced, or, you know, we just, like, the idea that the dominant is invisible is something that gets appropriation more, you know, that, like, lends itself to appropriation more, it lends itself to the power structure a little bit more. So it kind of do and, like, force a lot of folks to be, like, identify one part of their identity that's belonging to a larger culture group. And some people have really interesting things like goat herders or, you know, like really interesting parts of them that are cultural. And so then we go into a discussion guideline. So trying to not make it just as like a comfortable space, but make it a safe space. So like also the physical needs that they need, but then everything that they need discussion wise, like don't say we say I statements, or make sure to know that like everybody here is coming with good intentions, or, you know, just to keep things in mind. Also, like, don't speak over each other, you know, things that I can enforce if ever things get out of hand. Be like, hey, folks, we agreed to do the discussion guidelines. We agreed to abide by them. And then we get into the definition activity about what culture is and what appropriation is, and then define what cultural appropriation is. And then it just becomes like a large group discussion. And I have some discussion questions about it, like about how integral culture is to our identities, what happens when cultural appropriation happens in a certain community. And folks usually have examples from their community that they want to talk about. And then what happens when like we get called out, or when we do the calling out for cultural appropriation. And then we usually get into like folks will bring up like, well, what is appreciation then? Like, what does a cultural appreciation look like? And then we'll kind of get into how to identify appreciation, or how to conduct cultural exchange even within different communities, you know. Mm-hmm. So we'll kind of at that point we'll be out of time.
I totally understand that. Yeah. We're talking to Surabhi Mahajan about her conversation project on cultural appropriation. I would love to hear what you, that idea of the difference between appropriation and appreciation, how those conversations or that conversation point happens, and what's been the dialogue.
Yeah. A lot of folks, especially sometimes older folks, you know, they'll say that I was taught to, you know, like either appreciate different parts of the world or, you know, and then we'll get into, but we're talking about appropriation here and the way certain folks have appreciated quote unquote parts of the world has resulted in appropriation. And then we'll get into the dialogue about what that difference looks like. And so a lot of the times, like, appreciation doesn't have the, it equalizes the power dynamics. So appropriation benefits from the power dynamics that are set up. And appreciation has this sort of reciprocity. So, like, one of my examples is, like, a national one about Urban Outfitters, like, how they take the turquoise jewelry from the Navajo Nation. And the Navajo Nation has sued them, you know, for the rights of that type of jewelry because they've taken it without their permission. And so, but Urban Outfitters has benefited in sales from it. So that's a clear example of like corporate cultural appropriation. So in that example, appreciation or exchange could have been like asking for permission from the Navajo Nation, getting to know more about the turquoise jewelry, first of all, like how it's supposed to be produced or how to ethically produce it, and then giving them some sort of like the monetary benefit from it, you know, that they make so much money off of different accessories or, you know, from that specific one, they could have give it like some sort of partnership deal, especially if they had done the front end process of knowing about it from them. So it's like equalizing power dynamics could have been like to give back money in some way or recognition in some way or form. And then like that reciprocity. And then also sometimes exchange or appreciation looks like not taking part of it, just getting to know about it, just getting to know the knowledge of it. So it's like maybe it means that you don't get to wear that dress, or maybe it means that you don't get to like wear those types of jewelry or whatever, you know. It just means that you get to know about the history because that person's taken time and knowledge and their own energy to tell you about it, and that's meaningful in itself, you know.
Yeah, I think that's an interesting point, and it kind of leads me to, you know, one of the points I've heard you talk about online is that these issues of appropriation can affect identity formation.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think, you know, you're kind of like alluding to, you know, some of those issues or possibilities. But I'd love to like hear how you think the action of either participating in cultural appropriation or, you know, kind of setting a line or a boundary affects how we shape who we are.
Yeah, because I think different cultures and like we ultimately get back to this idea of like racial and ethnic type of cultures or cultures that are more marginalized. So like people of color or, you know, we end up talking about these types of cultures in the conversation. But the like you're especially like talking for me personally, like my culture as a South Asian, like woman of color, I've grown up within that culture. And so the different tangible aspects of my culture, seeing it decontextualized or seeing it happen without like people that look like me or without the knowledge of that comes with that, it seems very strange. And then it is kind of hurtful just to see that without that context and to see it without that knowledge and not to see myself or see people like that look like me participate in that type of or being invited to those types of things. It's very confusing. And then a lot of the times the way cultural appropriation happens can be pretty harmful, you know, that because it's so decontextualized. So one of the things in Oregon, or like I've seen like this new age or new spirit type of situation, and like one of the traditions that folks in one of the native communities do is sweat lodges. So it's like when white people appropriate sweat lodges, that can be pretty harming, like physically harming if they do it wrong. You know, even if they have like 5 or 10 years of experience, they can still mess up because that's nothing compared to centuries of experience that another person might have passed down to them, you know. And so appropriating it and decontextualizing it can be pretty harmful for a community. And it can kind of take away that cultural context. It can take away somebody else's culture from them or harm somebody else's culture by not seeing people like them being represented in that culture, even though that's when I know or somebody else knows that that's the way it's supposed to be, you know.
Right. Without context, not only are you watering down or maybe almost could be said insulting a particular tradition or culture or ethnicity, but on the other side, if you don't know what you're doing, it could literally be problematic.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think that's interesting as well. It was very insightful to hear you describe yourself as a daughter of an immigrant family, a college graduate, and mm-hmm. how those descriptors, you know, anchored you in the world. What are those descriptors and why are those descriptors important to you and important in this conversation as a leader, a facilitator, or just a human being anchoring in this space?
I like to give how power is relative, like power dynamics aren't ultimately like not set in stone. Like one person can have many different forms of power, many forms of like powerlessness as well, because it's relative and like we all have different forms of identities within us. So it's like as an immigrant that has both power and powerlessness associated with it, so having to assimilate but then immigrating to a land, you know, kind of confirms the state that we live in, and then being college educated, that's a really big form of power for me. Because as a woman, as a brown woman, there's so many different situations where I feel like lost in power. But then because I have a higher education, I feel like I can belong, you know, because of that education. So it's like, it's different for a lot of different folks. But I like to, those identities really like help me figure out who I am, you know, because it's like I can't control my, like, how I feel when I, like, when there's like all older white people that are taller than me and, you know, have been here for a longer time in the room. But then it's like I remember that, or I feel like I can at least have something to contribute because I've, you know, gone to school, or it's like I've been able to navigate those spaces where it's been a lot mostly white people, or it's like I have experience, you know. So it's just like those different types of my identities help me like figure out like where do I belong, or where do I want to belong, or how can I belong, or especially for folks that are like children of immigrants are sometimes very shy, and I was very shy, but then, you know, like relying on that education piece has helped me like come out, or just at least state who I am in a space that I feel really uncomfortable in. So it's like it's a dichotomy for me sometimes. It's like I don't belong because of these identities, but then I feel like I can belong because of this part, you know?
Yeah, I totally understand it. I want to get into another identity when we come back. You're an Oregonian, and I'd like to know how that's played a role in, you know, you navigating those same spaces, but also what you're hearing in terms of folk who engage with you in this topic. And I want to get into some of your other interests as well, and your other work as well.
Great.
I'm talking to Surabhi Mahajan, and we're talking about cultural appropriation and how it affects identity. Come back after first short break. We're back with the final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Robert Goodwin. I'm speaking with Surabhi Mahajan, and we're talking about how people view cultural appropriation. You're welcome to join this conversation. Give us a call at 800-838-3760 or email comments and questions to jx@jeffnet.org. Surabhi, you're an Oregonian, and where are you from?
Salem.
Okay. What role did growing up in Oregon and your family rearing play on your current, you know, interest in this area? But most definitely also we should get into your work as a, you know, food and agricultural advocate as well, and how that links to this conversation, because I think it does.
Yeah, especially with land. In the last conversation I had in Grant Pass, I think it was a weekend ago, it was one of the best conversations I've ever had, because we were able to get into like this idea of not only cultural appreciation, but like maybe even this idea of talking about, you know, settler colonialism, and especially this relationship that we have with land as Oregonians. Like, we call ourselves Oregonians, but we're literally living on land that was violently appropriated, you know, from folks that were here before us. And so it's like we were able to get into that that idea that how do we continue living here, but then also, you know, like actually appreciate or actually honor or give this idea of being in Oregon, like living in such a beautiful space, like its true meaning. And that means like learning about the history or learning about the different reservations that are across the state, and how do we support them, or how do we support their endeavors, because they're doing a lot of important work for themselves, you know. So like we were able to get into that, which is I've never been able to do that before, which was awesome. Yeah,
that's great. John from Eugene, you're on the air.
Hello. You got me?
Got you. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, I appreciate this conversation, and I like listening to Sarah B. She's a positive spirit. So here's from the white privilege perspective, I guess. Another word I think of in this current conversation, I mean, these days of cultural appropriation, is heritage. You know, we all have a heritage. Mm-hmm. And the speculation societally is that in 100 years from now, we'll all be kind of a brown mix anyway. We're kind of on our way to something different. And so I wonder sometimes in these struggles, in these conversations, what's our common bond? And I think our common bond is our humanity, which we manage to share or can't manage to share in the moment. That's what I think. Mm. And maybe that's a white privilege thing. I don't know what that is. But if we can't do that, if we can't be sincere and friendly to each other in the moment, moment to moment to moment, there's nothing else.
Most definitely. Thank you for your comment. Civility is a huge piece of this. But I think, you know, of course, context, cultural context and awareness is as well. And so the combination fits together in a piece that moves us forward as human beings. What do you think, Sarah B?
And then I think, like, the intention of sometimes what the impact of cultural appropriation, the intention a lot of the times is to appreciate. But then if you get called out, or if the result is in exploiting or benefiting, and like folks get aware of that, but your intention actually was to appreciate, like, you'll change your action a little bit. And I think that's what folks end up getting away from the conversation, is how to match their action with their intention of, like, sharing and humanity. Because I do agree, it's like, no matter where you go, like, you'll have some sort of culture shock, but then you'll end up, folks will end up accepting, and, you know, you'll become a part of the place. And so the common link is humanity. But then how do you, like, intentionally and very civilly as well, like, or humanely, share with each other? Because this appropriation does happen, like theft and stealing, and then exploitation does happen in our current society. So how do we differentiate between the two? And then how do we promote appreciation more than we currently in our society do appropriation, you know?
We're talking to Sarah B. Mahajan about cultural appropriation. You have a lot of experience as a farmer and community-supported agriculture advocate.
Mm-hmm.
I want to get to, you know, this conversation of how your work as a food advocate deals with, you know, exploring cultural appropriation. And you kind of spoke to it, the commonality of land being
right.
an important, you know, element that bridges. I'm assuming, maybe I shouldn't assume, maybe I should let you speak to it about what the bridge is or how they link in your work and life.
Yeah, food is such a, like, it's such a common, and especially the production of food, like the production of labor, or, you know, how organic food itself has been produced in our society. Like, I feel like that's been appropriated, that the way a lot of communities used to grow food for themselves, it's been that's been taken into capital production of food, you know. So it's like the way we currently produce mass produced food in our society is so bad for our health, it's bad for our land and everything like that. So going back and actually doing organic without pesticides, without like any chemicals, that's, it's seen as the new wave, you know. But we forget that that's how folks used to grow food, or that's how food is still grown a lot around the world, like south of the equator, you know. And so, like, yeah, I would agree that there's a lot of commonalities, and just in the production of food, and then especially by women, like in farming today. Farming is seen as such a male-dominated field, but then, like, a lot of the labor that I'm familiar with farming, or, you know, that comes from South Asia, comes from women, like, you know, or like women are integral to the process. And there's no differentiation, or there's not a lot of, like, power given to either gender with regarding food production, because the ultimate goal is about, you know, sustaining your life and taking care of the land. But here, I think there's a lot of differentiation that, like, there's a lot of, like, farmers' wives tales, or, like, I'm the partner of a farmer. Like, I'm not a farmer myself, but, like, I I do want to say that, like, yeah, I grow food, and it's like I am a farmer, or, you know, like as a woman or as a woman of color, I think that's a thing, a powerful thing to say, or like the reclamation, you know, in today's society. And it does connect with this idea of like power dynamics and appropriation and culture, you know.
Right. And do you see that link in the next step of food production to, you spoke to the capital systemic, you know, issues.
Yeah.
I think a lot of times, you know, I see in this area appropriative acts via food and restaurants.
Yeah.
And I think I try to like kind of, you know, discern whether or not it's just that there are a lack of people of color in the area,
right,
or, you know, or is it in a just intentional way of like seeing a market and taking advantage of it?
Yeah, no, I agree. There's this whole like culture of food writers or food media that really does talk about how people of color or like communities of color have taken more reclamation over the food that they that comes from their communities. So there's this really interesting article about who owns Southern Food, because right now Southern Food's becoming such a big, like, gastronomic, you know, like, restaurant culture. Like, a lot of restaurants are taking it over, or this idea that, like, white people own Southern Food, or the relationship to white people in the South relating to Southern Food. But Southern Food has been, like, mostly does come from, like, Black people in the area, about how they have literally survived through good food, you know, through making good food for themselves. And then now it's such a, like, it's becoming like a trendy thing. It's and then the trendy part is giving, is being given ownership to the dominant culture. But then this idea that, like, who actually owns Southern Food, like, where does Southern Food come from, you know, it's really important to understand that history. And then not, like, I mean, talking about ownership is hard with food, but because it's such, you know, it's like food evolves and tastes evolve and everything like that. And then, like, I never say that, like, folks can't eat food from different, you know, cuisines or anything like that. Like, I really enjoy eating, like, Mexican food for myself. But then also eating, like, you can't say that you're eating Mexican food and eating from a place that's similar to Taco Bell, you know? Like, that's not Mexican food, like, or that's, then don't call it that. You know, if you want to eat from a specific place, just don't call it that. Or if you want to make a food that's similar, don't call it authentic Mexican cuisine, because it's probably not, you know. So I think this idea of appropriation with food makes things, like, you just want it to be more accurate than what it actually is, you know. Like, a lot of folks market it as something, but then as a consumer, I think folks need to know, or need to know for themselves, it's like, where the actual thing is, and is that something I want to eat or no, you know?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm thinking about all of the example. When you said Southern food and cuisine, I sort of was like, I think I know where you're going. But then I was
right.
Like, oh, this is soul food. And the difference between, you know, what used to be categorized in,
yes,
you know, in my rearing as soul food, now becoming,
yep,
Southern cuisine, but yep, the menus being, you know, and preparations being pretty darn similar. And
yeah,
and what that is, and what are the, you know, the perceptions of what it is to go to either of those spaces and engage,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Very interesting stuff. You talk about this whole work as a means of developing awareness versus restriction in terms of things,
mm-hmm,
that you can't do. How are you able, or do you feel like you're able to develop awareness in the folk that come? Or do you feel like there's, it's more of a, you know, they leave,
yeah,
feeling, you know, kind of, you know, I guess disciplined a little bit, or,
yeah,
for lack of a better way of saying it.
Right. No, I think folks, maybe 98%, you know, like that 2%, I feel like I know who those folks are, but 98% of it, I think everybody leaves with a certain, or just willingness or excitement to keep talking about the topic. Like, and I have a resource list that I give folks that, like, has some books or that really delves into some of the topics. One of them is like unpacking your privilege, or the knapsack of privilege, I forget, you know, but this idea that like privilege is a big topic and sometimes we can't get super into it. So it's like there's a resource list for that. So like folks can keep talking about it. But I really do think that people leave more excited or with a refreshed excitement to talk about it, because I think people have gotten into frustrating conversations before, because I don't think that we know how to have this conversation, and we end up replicating it every single time something happens, either in our community or in pop culture, or, you know, just in the, like, in the sphere that we live in. Things keep happening almost every 6 months, I feel like. Mm-hmm. And we end up having, is this or is this not? And if it is, how do we crucify this person, or how do we, you know, shut it down? But, like, I think then there's still that sect of folks that are just like, well, why did they have to do that? Or why did that happen? Or this was an overreaction. And they don't really understand why, you know. So I think the folks that I have been able to be in conversation with, they leave with this, like, they want to keep talking about it. Because I think just knowing what cultural appropriation is really changes the conversation. Like, it gets mislabeled. Like, this idea of feminism, like, you know, I people know what it really is, but then the way we talk about it, it gets so misrepresented that we don't want to identify as feminist, or, you know, it's like people feel shamed for being identified as that.
Right.
So just really knowing what the definition is, and then how folks are able to come into it for themselves, I think is important, because they learn it for themselves instead of being taught or being disciplined, you know?
Right. Well, Surabhi Mahajan, thank you for being here. I appreciate your work.
Thank you.
And I'm sure we can find out where your next conversation projects are on the Oregon Humanities website.
Yeah.